From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, we look at the challenges laid out by President Obama in yesterday's address as he takes his message on the road to kickstart his year of action.
While Congress decides whether it's going to raise the minimum wage or not, people outside of Washington are not waiting for Congress, and I'm not either.
A UN report says governments of poor countries are losing hundreds of billions on substandard education. Japan announces a major breakthrough in stem cell research. We find out what that could mean for our future health. And we speak to the MP responsible for whistleblower Edward Snowden's Nobel Peace Prize nomination.
I think that Edward Snowden has contributed more actually to world peace the past year than many earlier laureates have.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. whistleblower Edward Snowden has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by two Norwegian parliamentarians, including a former government minister. Snor Javan and Bard Vegas Nuyel say the former intelligence contractor's revelations over U.S. spying programs deserve recognition for contributing to transparency and global stability. Earlier today, Snor Javan spoke with Feature Story News about the nomination.
He deserves the Nobel Peace Prize simply because he has made an actual contribution to a more peaceful world order. And even though I think that his disclosures might have hurt many countries' security interests in the short term, I think that the policy changes that are brought forward by his disclosure are important and has led to the reintroduction of trust as a valuable currency on the world scene.
Ukraine's parliament is debating an amnesty for protesters detained during clashes with police during weeks of demonstrations. The country's government resigned on Tuesday, and anti-protest laws passed 2 weeks ago have now been scrapped. But the country's political crisis continues, with protesters still in the streets. Tom Barton reports.
Ukraine's embattled President Viktor Yanukovych wants an amnesty conditional on protesters taking down their barricades and leaving blockaded government buildings. Opposition leader and ex-boxing champion Vitali Klitschko is one of those who reject that, saying the struggle is now for a return to the 2004 constitution, which reduces the president's powers. Unrest began in November, when President Yanukovych refused to sign a long-awaited trade and reform deal with the European Union under heavy Russian pressure. Clashes began after the laws virtually banned all forms of protest. At least five people have since been killed, and protests have spread all over the country, even to Yanukovych's traditional power base in eastern Ukraine, with loud calls for early elections. Tom Barton, Moscow.
In the wake of his State of the Union address, President Obama visited retail giant Costco to reinforce his message about raising the minimum wage. It was the first in a series of similar stops. Costco is known for its much better than average employee pay and benefits. In his address, the president emphasized closing the income gap, calling for employers across the country to, quote, give America a raise, saying it would boost both morale and the economy. A rare winter storm is causing chaos in the southern U.S. Thousands of people, including children on school buses, were left stranded on highways for nearly 20 hours in Atlanta, Georgia. National Guard troops have been called in to help provide transportation for maroon motorists. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. United Nations inspectors have visited a mine in Iran as part of a trip to investigate the country's nuclear program. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear watchdog, is there following an agreement with Tehran to let inspectors in. Nick Harper has more from UN headquarters in New York.
It's the first time the IAEA has been to the uranium mine in southern Iran since 2005. It's part of an agreement Tehran made back in November with six UN member state countries, Iran agreeing to limit its nuclear program if sanctions against the country are eased. The IAEA visit comes at a time of renewed hope of tensions easing between Iran and the West, especially as the country now has Hassan Rouhani, a more moderate president, at the helm. Iran has always denied trying to make atomic weapons, instead saying its nuclear program is for medical and energy use.
And the UK is set to temporarily resettle some of the most vulnerable Syrian refugees. Its resettlement program, however, will be separate from the UN scheme, which has seen Germany commit to taking in 10,000 refugees from the Syrian conflict. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Girls and women who've been victims of or are at risk of violence, torture victims, and the elderly and disabled will be given priority by the UK. The government is not setting a specific target, but says it expects the number of refugees accepted to be in the hundreds. Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg says it means Britain's long and proud tradition of providing refuge continues. Politicians on all sides have criticised the government for not signing up to the UNHCR's initiative on Syrian refugees. The government insists it has UNHCR backing for its move and points out it is the second biggest bilateral donor of humanitarian aid to Syria in the world.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Late Tuesday night, President Obama used his annual State of the Union address to call for measures that create jobs, raise workers' wages, and narrow the widening divide between the rich and the poor in the United States. He said he will work with Congress in the coming year to achieve these goals, but if Congress can't get the job done, he will use executive powers to take action without them. The president expanded on some of these same themes in a speech Wednesday morning in neighboring Maryland.
Just last year alone, workers earning the minimum wage basically got the equivalent of a $200 pay cut because the minimum wage stayed the same, but costs of everything else are going up. While Congress decides whether it's going to raise the minimum wage or not, people outside of Washington are not waiting for Congress, and I'm not either. So as a chief executive, I'm going to lead by example.
Our correspondent Alice Olstein was in the Capitol for the State of the Union and brings us this report.
In his fifth State of the Union address, President Barack Obama focused on turning over a new leaf after a year dominated by partisan gridlock, a government shutdown, the ongoing fight over his signature health care reform law, and a financial recovery that most Americans are barely feeling.
But what I offer tonight is a set of concrete, practical proposals to speed up growth, strengthen the middle class, and build new ladders of opportunity into the middle class. Some require congressional action, and I am eager to work with all of you. But America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
Lawmakers leaving the State of the Union speech were deeply divided over the president's focus on using executive actions to bypass Congress as part of a so-called year of action. Minnesota Republican Michelle Bachmann said she is planning to pass a resolution of disapproval in the House and even sue the president if he pursues this path.
He's the president of the United States. He's not a king. He may think he's a king. He may declare himself king, but that's not what he is under our Constitution. That's why we have to take our authority under the Constitution as the House of Representatives and go forward, which the parliamentarian has told us we have this authority to do. Hire an attorney once we pass this resolution and hold the president accountable. And I think that if the president continues to go down this road, he needs to be prepared for a fight and a challenge. He better be prepared for the lawsuit the United States Congress will bring to him.
Many other lawmakers, including Virginia Democrat Jerry Connolly, disagreed. He said the president is not only allowed to act without congressional approval, he is morally obligated to do so.
This president got a mandate not once but twice. This president is the first Democratic president since FDR to win both times with an absolute majority of the electorate. He has a mandate. This Congress has frustrated that mandate for partisan political reasons and actually in defiance of the American public. So what is a president to do? He is to use those executive powers he has in a constitutional framework. And I think he should.
Other lawmakers left the State of the Union concerned more about what they did not hear. In a few short paragraphs toward the end of the speech, the president touched on reforms he claims to have made to programs that monitor communications in the U.S. and around the world. He also said he's already, quote, imposed prudent limits on the use of drones, a claim Florida Democrat Alan Grayson disputes.
I don't know what the president's even talking about. As far as I can see, there's no limits on drones, and the result of that is over 200 dead children, 200 dead innocent children. I'm not happy with that program at all. I don't think he's demonstrated that it makes us any safer.
Grayson also said he wished the president had given more specifics about what reforms to the nation's surveillance programs he will support, especially because the speech followed several weeks of court rulings and government reports questioning the effectiveness and legality of those programs.
There's no conceivable legal or constitutional basis for what the NSA is engaging in, which is pervasive domestic surveillance of everyone. I think that a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats agree that it's wasteful and stupid and pointless to have our internet activity, our telephone activity, our physical location, all sorts of information handed over to the government on a regular basis. It makes us not only guilty until proven innocent, but guilty regardless.
Despite the near total silence on the issue in the president's State of the Union, NSA surveillance will likely be a major topic in the months ahead. At a Senate hearing Wednesday morning, some lawmakers blasted representatives from the CIA and NSA for what they called the Obama administration's culture of misinformation, and they vowed to continue to demand transparency and accountability from the executive branch. Grayson said he's confident a bill to reform the spying programs can pass Congress this year. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Well, Amy Walter, who's the national editor for the Cook Political Report, was watching President Obama's speech last night with FSN's Lorna Shaddick, and they spoke afterwards about some of the key themes that arose.
This really was a speech that was focused almost exclusively on the domestic economic agenda. This is a president that knows that that is the number one issue on the minds of Americans. This is a president and a White House that signaled that they were going to go above Congress, go around Congress. But this speech really was not particularly confrontational. He looked for a lot of opportunities to point out the success that he's had working across the aisle. In essence, this was a president who was trying to meet the American audience where they are, which is they're wary of the Washington gridlock, frustrated by what they see as partisanship, and hungry for some competence in Washington.
He seemed to be implying that would be coming from him. A lot of emphasis on executive actions. How realistic are those, really?
Well, we've seen, for example, on the minimum wage. It's an issue that he's been talking about for some time. And he's able to raise the minimum wage for some federal workers. We don't know what the final numbers will be, but maybe it's a couple hundred thousand people. That's a success, but it's nowhere near the kind of success that he would like to see, of course, which is for millions of people to benefit from this. So usually when you're talking about executive orders, you can get some things done, but you really can't move as far into the private sector as many Democrats would like to be able to see.
And one issue on which he himself can't act, on which he really needs Congress, immigration reform, quite a big appeal, again, for Republicans and Democrats to work together and get something done on that.
Well, and it was interesting, he spent not too much time on that issue, even though it may be the one big piece of legislation that may come out of this next Congress. There's just a budding hope among many advocates that Republicans in Congress may be able to put something together. They've been really what's been stopping immigration reform from moving forward. In some ways, I think the fact the president didn't spend so much time on this was also an asset to Speaker John Boehner. He knows that the kiss of death for any legislation with his caucus is if the president says he likes it, then it's almost certain that Republicans are going to say they hate it.
Moving on to healthcare reform, another tough one for the president. He clearly had to mention it, but it's been a difficult rollout. He didn't really mention any of those difficulties, did he?
No, and I don't think he would want to remind people about that. It's notable that this is his signature achievement as president, and yet it took him probably a good 40 minutes before he even mentioned that issue. Democrats who were sitting in that audience, that is the issue they are most concerned about going into the 2014 elections. It's not just the website. Their concern is that there will be some other problems that are related to this implementation of healthcare. There is still a tremendous amount of concern among Democrats out there that the 2014 election is going to be a referendum on Obamacare.
Now, moving on to foreign policy, in particular, the interim nuclear deal with Iran.
You know, the fact that he came right out and said something that we know he's been thinking about for a while, but basically saying, this deal is going to work. I want to make it work. Trust me, I'm going to protect our interests. But if you send me a sanctions bill, I will veto it. This is one of those interesting issues, though, that it wasn't just aimed at Republicans. There are a lot of Democrats in that audience who would also sign on to a sanctions bill. So this is the president asserting himself on what is now probably his most high-profile and riskiest foreign policy venture right now.
Maybe a bit of a tough one, but if you could sum this speech up in a sentence or a phrase.
His big idea would be, I am looking out for you. And he doesn't say it as explicitly, but the other guys aren't.
Amy Walter, national editor for the Cook Political Report. This is FSN Reports. Former NSA contractor Edward Snowden has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. His nomination was put forward by two Norwegian MPs who would like to see the whistleblower receive the same award won by US President Barack Obama in 2009. Snorre Valen, one of the MPs responsible for the nomination, told me why he was championing Edward Snowden.
Well, I think he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize because he has made an actual contribution to a more peaceful world order. And even though I think that his disclosures might have hurt many countries' security interests in the short term, I think that the policy changes that are brought forward by his disclosure are important and has led to the reintroduction of trust as a valuable currency on the world scene. And that's very important and a very good thing.
And what's the reaction been so far to your decision to put forward Mr. Snowden?
Lots of cheers from many people, and some people obviously disagree, but this is a matter of principle, I think. I'm aware that he's not the most popular man everywhere, but on the other hand, even the New York Times in its editorial said that we should try to bargain with Snowden to get him back home. I think there's, in broad political environments, there is an understanding of why he did what he did. And I think that's important. I also trust the U.S. to respect the fact that the Nobel Committee is an independent committee, and that if the prize goes to Edward Snowden, that I'm sure that wouldn't affect the relations between the U.S. and Norway as it has between Norway and China after the Liu Xiaobo Peace Prize.
He was overlooked or pipped narrowly to Time Magazine's Person of the Year by Pope Francis. Assuming he wins this prize, if he gets that far, he would join the likes of United States President Barack Obama, who heads a government that considers Edward Snowden a fugitive rather than a whistleblower.
Yeah, absolutely. And it would be an interesting lunch, you know, with the former Nobel Peace Prize laureates and Edward Snowden. But I think to Obama's credit, he has also brought about changes in the policies directed towards the NSA, what they're allowed to do and so on. And I hope it's because, at least a bit because he wants to and not just because he has to. I think that Edward Snowden has contributed more actually to world peace the past year than many earlier laureates have.
There are those who perhaps consider the influence of the Academy's award as minimal, less significant than perhaps it once was. I mean, are you of that opinion? Do you think Edward Snowden being awarded this, were he to get that far, would actually have an impact?
I think that the importance of the award, the Peace Prize, depends on who gets the prize and nothing else. And I think that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee would strengthen its legitimacy even more if it were to award a Peace Prize to a laureate who has also acted against Western countries and Western democracies. And that's a central point also because he has exposed the depth and the volume of surveillance in democratic countries. And if democracies and liberal states like my own and like the U.S. are to properly condemn and be able to change the censorship and oppression in authoritarian states. We have to be very clear about what's allowed to do and not when surveying and doing legitimate intelligence work at home.
But it's also potentially the case that were he to find himself picking up the award, the Nobel Peace Prize award in Oslo, Norway, that he wouldn't be able to attend in person because, of course, he's in Russia in temporary asylum.
Yeah, he is. And that's something that neither the Nobel Committee or we as parliamentarians can do very much about. But it is something to think about and reflect on, that Edward Snowden is a fugitive and had to take refuge in a state like Russia, where there is multiple attacks on the freedom of expression, where gay people are being practically hunted in the city of Sochi and so on. He shouldn't be forced to take refuge in such a country. He should be able to live in a free democracy and a free country, because that's the values he has promoted by disclosing the information that he has disclosed.
Norwegian MP Snorre Valen. The global pledge to give all children access to a primary school education will wildly miss the planned target of 2015. A new UN report says it's a goal the world is still decades away from achieving. Nick Harper has the details from the UN headquarters in New York.
The sound of children learning. By next year, it was meant to be the noise that every child could experience. According to a report from the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, that won't be the case. In fact, they say it could take another 70 years until every child has access to a primary school education. Here's Kate Redman from UNESCO.
The report is actually showing that there's another very key issue that we need to be taking very seriously, which is how many children are in school but aren't learning anything. So, for example, around the world, there are 250 million children in this situation. It's the poorest children, it's the girls, and it's those who live in rural, remote areas who are faring the worst.
In what the report's author, Pauline Rose, describes as, quote, shocking figures, complete global access to primary school education will only be achieved by 2086. Vastly missing the pledged target of 2015, given by global leaders. In September 2000, the United Nations Millennium Declaration was established, with the goal of reducing extreme poverty. As part of the declaration, 8 Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs, were set up to act as a blueprint in targeting issues from HIV and AIDS to poverty and access to education. According to the UNESCO report released on Wednesday in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, that target for education by 2015, at least, was wildly optimistic. This UNESCO report is an annual monitoring update on the Millennium Pledge for Education and describes the situation as, quote, a growing learning crisis. The report states that in some of the world's poorest countries, as many as 1 in 4 children can't read a single sentence. UNESCO also cite concerns that in many countries the situation is deteriorating, with aid to education projects dwindling and not reaching the nations most in need. China currently receives the most aid for education, an amount around 77 times more than that of Chad.
Often teachers will drop out because they're not receiving enough pay. Sometimes teachers are receiving only $10 a month. It's not enough for them to live on. So they'll leave the profession in order to find another job. What's important is that governments look at, for example, career development or better pay. That will mean that these teachers who have had some training and are keen to help the most disadvantaged learn will stay there and help us fix the problem.
This report is based on the latest figures from 2011 and states that there are some 57 million children across the world that don't have access to basic schooling. If the project target of 2086 is accurate, UNESCO say it's poor rural girls that will be the last to access education. According to the report author's estimates, 5-year-olds that are missing out on education now will be grandmothers by the time universal access to schooling is finally achieved. Nick Harper, New York.
A major scientific discovery. That's the claim from stem cell researchers in Japan. The team of experts have created what's been called a master cell, capable of transforming into any other type of human cell. Scientists maintain that stem cells could one day lead a path to regenerating tissue and organs. Earlier, I spoke to Dr. Janet Roussant, president of the International Society for Stem Cell Research, and began by asking her why this latest discovery had created such a buzz among the medical community.
Well, it is really quite a surprising study, I have to say. Over the last few years, there have been a lot of breakthroughs in our ability to take cells from our body and turn them right back into what we call pluripotent early embryonic cells. So Shinya Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize a few years ago now for discovering that you could take skin cells and turn them into pluripotent cells. But he did that by adding a set of factors and genes, and quite a complicated, inefficient process. What this group shows is they took cells from the blood and changed the pH, made them a little bit more acid, just changed the environment a little bit, and then were able to select out from those cells cells that, again, seem to behave like these very early embryonic cells that were pluripotent and able to make essentially all the tissues of a mouse. So it's pretty surprising because, you know, that's a hard thing to do. Our adult cells are very specialized. Our early embryo cells are really quite different. They can make every cell type in our body, and they're not specialized at all. So just changing the acid? Interesting.
Do I detect some doubt in your voice?
Well, I think it's so amazing that it will be very important that we see how far this can go. They worked on a number of different tissues. It would be interesting to see how many different cell types they can actually get to change fate. And this was all done in the mouse, which is very important and a very good model system because you can really test the potential of the cells. But it will, of course, be very important to see whether the same kind of approach works in human cells.
I think for many people, the interest, obviously, in stem cell research and development lies in the ability to regenerate tissue or organs some way down the line in the future. Where are we at the moment, and where could research of this calibre take us?
Well, the ability to take pluripotent cells, these cells that can make every cell type, is great, and the potential is great because they make all the cell types of our body. But we're still quite a long way off from being able to take pluripotent embryonic type cells into cells that we can actually use for therapy, although we're starting to see the first clinical trials. There's a couple of clinical trials now taking retinal pigment cells that have been derived from these pluripotent cells in culture and using them to treat patients with macular degeneration. So there's a real clinical trial in place. We're seeing stem cells not just from these pluripotent stem cells, but adult stem cells of various sorts also being used in a number of different therapeutic options. But the long-term goal of really being able to treat some of the more debilitating, devastating chronic diseases like diabetes, Parkinson's, and those kinds of diseases is absolutely on the agenda, but not quite there in terms of delivery yet, but it's very, very active research. This particular research just adds another twist to the source of cells that we might be able to. It suggests that maybe, if we understood it properly, we might be able to get our own tissues to help regenerate themselves. So if we could stress them inside our bodies, maybe they would allow us to regenerate our own tissues.
Dr. Janet Roussant, President of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Wednesday, FSN Reports takes you deep underground the streets of the Russian capital. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.